Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green. I too will be looking for one of those AC12 soccer jerseys. It's Monday, the 12th of April, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, we've got our sporting highlights from the weekend, and if you can't guess mine, you've been living under a rock and you shouldn't be listening to this show.
The old female rider has won the Grand National. Rachel Blackmore is out in front. She's just ebbing away energy-wise, but one of the great Grand National stories being told on this cold April afternoon. Rachel Blackmore becomes the first female rider to win the Grand National. What an amazing story.
It was an epic weekend of rugby with big wins for Ireland, Ulster and the Boys in Blue.
Racing inside the 22, pops it across there to James Lowe. Charging forward with that one, James Lowe for Leinster, touches it down, and that is the score that Leinster so badly needed. It's come through James Lowe after 17 minutes.
Plus in football, we've Stephen Kelly and Conan Byrne standing by to review some interesting results in the Premier League and League of Ireland.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. I'm not allowed to talk about my highlights, since we're going to do it a little later in the show, so we're going to have to move over that one. But if you do have highlights...
It's just so obvious, Ruby.
Yeah. I know, isn't it? But if you do have your highlight, please tweet it into us or text it to us. And if it's not Rachel Blackmore in the Grand National, don't bother. only messing.
It was incredible, wasn't it?
That was amazing, but we'll get to that in a little while. Donegal, it was a big weekend in rugby, and it was a pretty emphatic win for the ladies' rugby team.
Yeah, it was a fantastic performance. We'd been chatting about it. I was a little bit nervous. I know everyone was chatting about the camps and the amount they got through of work, but playing games is different. But they looked a class apart, and I think Niamh Briggs summed it up really well in commentary and her analysis. Just chatting about body angles and contact, and the body fight was just incredible. They must have really been putting themselves through their paces in camp. I'd say they knocked lumps out of each other to come back that raring to go. So it was a great win.
Yeah, and it was such a long time to not have anything competitive that you have to give them huge credit for the way that they have evolved by themselves in that high performance setup without being tested outside it. And my highlight was actually Bavin Parsons' try and just her whole outlook really on the game. I'd interviewed her before it and she was telling me that she just wanted to go out and play like she was a kid and enjoy it, and I thought that came across really, really well. But you could just see the energy that she had, and obviously the pace is absolutely amazing, but the confidence as well, just to be able to go the whole way. It didn't matter if there was someone running off her, she was going for that try line, she didn't care. And I just love seeing somebody so young having that confidence just to go for it, and I just find her so entertaining.
There had to be a connection with Bevan Parsons when you went for her over Hannah Tyrrell, who was just outstanding. A couple of crossfield kicks, her, the way she controlled the game. I knew there had to be a reason you were going for Bevan Parsons. You interviewed her last Saturday.
I'm interviewing Hannah Tyrrell for next week. So
Monday, that'll be the highlight, will it?
Yeah.
But you know what was brilliant? Just from being around it, having confidence to leave someone play there for a bit of time. And that's what we've done, Adam Griggs and the management have done with Hannah. They've left her find her way of playing. And you're right, Marie, we have a back three you could only wish for. Like Eimear Considine, for just looking for work off the ball, is incredible. You may have mentioned Bevan Parsons. Like, her footwork is just ridiculous. It really is. She can left foot, right foot step. She chop steps. It's dangerous. But for me, the area of difference, honestly, and I know you're going to say, oh, typical Dunders going for the forwards. Our pack, we have a pack of workhorses.
Between your pack now and Ruby's racing.
But Linda,
we need is a bit of GAA and look, yeah,
We're away. But when you even look at our Dorothy Wall in our back row, I don't think I've seen someone to be that far ahead in back rows since someone like David Wallace, who we were around. You're just, you know, when you're playing with them or you see them and you're there, they're just freaks. They're freakish. And look, I think it could all come at really good timing for our Irish players, because in the background there's an awful lot of talks about a women's British and Irish Lions team, and I think with performances like Saturday, I think we'd have an awful lot of players that not only could go to that level but could come back from it, like you mentioned, in 19 years of age, or come back with massive experience and really add to it.
Yeah, and Stacey Flood as well made her debut. I might have mentioned her once or twice on the show, Ruby. I don't think you were here. I actually played in a Gaelic football team with her. That's how young imagine, I am. Imagine to make your debut.
You bet. I often hear of GA teams like drafting in the under 16, so they must have drafted in the under 12s if you played with her.
It was pretty much something like that. But look, I mean, I'm gonna dine out on this now. She's got a good 10-15 year career ahead of her. Like, I've got a lot of mileage.
And
on
says
Stacey
she's
Flood.
She's gonna love when you keep saying that in about 12 years time. I played in the football team with her. She's just
and
gonna think, well,
we
that
county final
stop.
And beat Parnells, and Lindsay Pete was playing for Parnells. There you go. I'm telling you, it's such a small.
And you ended up in radio. What went wrong, Marie?
No, I actually was texting Stacey about it, and I was like, great to see you, you know. I was like, you can go in so many different paths. And she was like you. I was like, I'd much prefer to be like you.
Crowbar, you're getting the complete opposite to me. I'm getting the, oh, you played with my uncle, or you played with my father. Whereas you're getting the, yeah, I played with those.
Played with the girl
kids
that made her debut the weekend.
Brilliant.
What about the golf, guys? No drama on the back nine in Augusta, which for, I suppose, casual golf fans like us kind of took away from the drama a bit, didn't it?
I was really looking forward to it because we had so much drama on the Thursday and Friday, and with Greg Allen on here going through it all with us, and it was kind of setting up to be a tight, tense affair, and there was lots of people in and out of it, and we had Rory and we had Shane, and Rory didn't go to plan, but it just kind of fell on its face a little bit on Sunday. There was a little bit of excitement for about 5 minutes on Sunday night, but
it was about 5 minutes.
That was it.
I did actually think when Jordan Spieth birdied the ninth and turned, I was thinking, you know, he's on 6 under, 5 under. He only has to get to 9 to have a chance here. And I thought there might be a little bit of drama. I thought Matsuyama will definitely do something. Like, he's, I'm all for playing things to win, but when you're that far ahead in the golf competition, you kind of have to balance it up a little bit. But he just kept chasing. I'm thinking he will stick one in the water somewhere because he's just chasing this, but it was all too late when he did.
It was, and I thought that Xander Schauffele as well might do something when the opportunity came, but he too blew it, and that was it. That was it for us.
I felt like a kid at a birthday party. When it came to it, I just had enough of sport nearly at that point. I was like, oh, here we go, lads. We can't keep going 12 o'clock at night. It can't be as gripping as it's been for the whole weekend. And to be fair,
I've had enough of cake.
Enough of cake. Thanks for the
I don't want to play anymore. There was the rowing as well, and we had some brilliant performances there as well. And I suppose we better give a nod to Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy, who won gold at the European Championship, yeah. And that was just part of a really busy weekend, but fair play to them as well. A nice lead in to the Olympics, and we have two Irish representatives as well in the final of the AFLW, the Adelaide Crows and the Brisbane Lions. They beat Melbourne and Collingwood respectively. So Tipperary's Orla O'Dwyer impressed for the Lions, and Ailish Considine, who is sister of Emer, so their mom was really busy, is involved in the Adelaide Crows. So that final is going to be on next weekend, so we will no doubt preview that as well. I'm sure there's loads of other things that we haven't mentioned yet, so if anybody wants to text us in, please do, because there really was so
that is one. There's one we have to mention though. We have to, at the top of the show, because there was a caller into RTE today giving out about the 2E.
Go on.
And a really high powered person in RTE took this call, and there was somebody complaining about
Brian Dobson.
Complaining about the anti-Leinster bias of Marie Crowe and Donegal Callan. He said he hopes that the Leinster are now in the semi-finals. You might be a bit fairer to the other Providence, considering we're all Irish. Now, the person who took this call did come to Donegal's defence and stood up for Donegal, so it appears like you're being thrown under the bus, Marie. How do you defend yourself?
But Donegal is very fair.
I suppose I am. You want to be balanced, don't you? And I suppose when I was playing in at Marie, there was massive rivalry because you're competing for shirts. But now, I just want Irish rugby to do really well. And I don't shy away from the fact that I'm a Munster man and I love it and I want Munster to do well. But I think, you know, it's really important for all the provinces. And right now, Leinster are the standard setters. And I want them to keep going so that all the other provinces have something to reach. And just being around it, I think, is really important. I think we are a little bit balanced. In fact, one of my buddies isn't chatting to me because when we were on with Stephen Ferris, I said, what we need to do at the weekend. When did you get to that point?
Yeah, I just like all my teams to win, and I'm from Munster, so I always want them to win. I can't help that.
But to be fair, Leinster probably are setting the standard across Europe, don't they?
They absolutely
not just
are.
Within Ireland.
Yeah, and we'll get on to it in a while. It was brilliant. It was another great win. They've set themselves up nicely. But they're doing brilliantly off the pitch as well, Ruby. There was news today that they've submitted plans with the government for rapid testing so that they could hopefully get spectators back to the RDS, and that would involve, I know it's small, but it's 2,000 supporters, which is only 11% of the crowds. And that would be brilliant, especially when it comes to the end of the season, to have family and friends and members of the squad that mightn't be involved, and a nice way to say goodbye. But I think it's important as well for setting the standard for other sports, that we could maybe show the way to getting crowds back for GAA, hurling, football, soccer, whatever it is. And fair play to Leinster on that.
Yeah, I think that all sports are going to be looking to see how Leinster get on. And actually, Leinster CEO Mick Dawson spoke to Drive Time a little bit earlier about it. Let's hear from him.
Well, we're suggesting the RDS, where most people know we play our home matches, but this could be done in the Aviva Stadium, it could be done in Croke Park, it could be done in Thomond Park, Musgrave Park, it could be done anywhere. We're suggesting the RDS Stadium holds about 18,500 people, and we're suggesting the pilot scheme would be for about 2,000 people who would get tested on the morning of a match and then follow up by being able to go to the match that evening. So they would, we have four stands in the RDS, so we're suggesting there'd be 500 people in each stand, two tickets together, both people from the same bubble, both testing negative, would be able to go to the match. Again, as I say, that's it in a nutshell.
It's a brilliant idea, but when you think that antigen tests aren't yet recognised by the government, is my understanding of it, they have to be PCR tests to be a negative. It's a big step. I mean, I love the theory of it. I mean, Punchestown Racecourse is 400 acres. You have 2,000 people in it standing 100 yards apart. But do you think, as a nation, we're receptive to this yet? Either of you?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I love that we're trying, Ruby. I like that we're coming up with plans, that we're actually thinking, how do we do little tests? How do we try to find a way to get people back to grounds? And you're right, look, the expertise and the government are going to have the final call, but I do think there's an onus as well on sporting bodies to kind of say, to keep pushing it and to keep the sport alive and to recognise the most important people, which are supporters. And I think I feel that's important.
And very shortly as well, we're going to start seeing crowds at test events in the UK. So when we start seeing that, I think that people will be more acceptable for the return of normality. But because we're just still in coming out of level 5 now,
we're so far behind the UK with the vaccine rollout, would that be the biggest difference?
There's a little bit of an issue with that, all right, but look, we're trying to get there. And I think when we see them playing FA Cup matches and people in there watching it, we will get used to the idea that we are going to return, there is going to be people at matches eventually, and if Leinster can push on and show everybody a way to do it, then I think they should be given the opportunity to at least try.
Can I put my red glasses back on and just give a special shout out to Tommy O'Donnell, who announced his retirement from rugby at the end of the season. He's been involved with Munster since 2007. A real boast for the fella is, when you talked out with him, he always gave his all. But a big thing, and I know it's massive for Tommy, is he came through the youth system, came through and always represented Tip and his family in an incredible way. And I just reading his statement today, how important it is for him to be recognised as a one club man. And I just, from togging out with him and playing with him, he always put his body on the line, a great fella to tog out with, and he should be really proud of his career, putting in a massive shift so many times for Munster.
I remember talking to him after he dislocated his hip.
Yeah, he took punishment, Ruby. He really did. And look, that's hopefully he goes away fit and healthy from the game. I've no doubt he will take bangs and knocks, though, because he was reckless when it came to his body.
Ruby, I imagine because when a lot of people think of injury, you are one of the first people that comes to mind. You get a lot of calls from people who are going through different things and are finding it difficult or just trying to find the best way to recover. What do you say to people when they ring you?
I actually can't remember, Marie, was it Paul O'Connell, I think, or Ronan, that were on to me about Tommy, because I had dislocated my hip years ago in the stall, and Tommy kind of felt it could be career ending, and it was more to reassure him that it wouldn't be, that it had been put back in and you would recover from it. That's what it was. What can you tell anybody? Marie, physical pain goes quicker than anybody realises. It's whatever mental scar it leaves on you as to how you come back. And if you can get over that, you'll be fine. But most injuries, given enough time, you'll get to the back of them.
Are you still getting calls?
Me, no, very rarely. I'm obviously not that approachable, but very, very rarely.
Thought it. Okay, there is some live football right now, actually, because West Brom and Southampton kicked off at 6 o'clock and Republic of Ireland international Callum Robinson was rewarded with a starting role. And so with Darragh O'Shea, who's recovered from an ankle problem. So that has kicked off at 6 o'clock and is nil all. And then at 8:15, it is Brighton against Everton. We are going to take a very quick break. And then Stephen Kelly and Conan Byrne are with us to talk about all of the football action.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is time to turn our attention to football. 16 minutes gone in the West Brom-Southampton game and still nil all there. Conan Byrne is with us and Stephen Kelly as well. Conan, to you first. It was one of those weekends where there were a lot of interesting results and a lot happened, but yet at the end of it, everyone is still talking about Jose Mourinho.
It's always about Jose Mourinho, Marie. I think we should, he always tries to make it about himself. After an abysmal display by his team, I thought Manchester United were absolutely superb on the day. I thought Paul Pogba was absolutely immense. But the highlight for me, I think, were the quality of the goals that were on show. The one-touch passing move between Fred, Rashford and Cavani for Fred's goal. Cavani's wonderful diving header after the Fernandez nutmeg and brilliant Mason Greenwood cross. And then Pogba's strength to leave it, to lay the ball into Mason Greenwood and a little dip of the shoulder and a wonderful finish. So, yeah, he can't really... I try not to talk about him too much because I think Manchester United were absolutely superb and they were full credit for their victory.
And Stephen, even the goal that was somehow disallowed was a wonderful goal.
Oh, it was a wonderful goal. It's almost one of those goals where you say, don't punish skill, because it was so nice in the eyes. Not from my point of view, from a Tottenham fan, and even the fact that it was taken away, and I was delighted about that. The manner in which it was taken away was just everything that I love about football and that I've gone through in football. It just dismay that was brought back for a free kick. Like, just, you mean, what are we going to teach kids these days? To put your arm up and not touch anybody. It's actually ridiculous to think that decision was given. But, you know, United ran out deserved winners, and Tottenham again just showed a complete capitulation from a winning position, that they just can't see games through. And, you know, it just seems really, really, they can't see it happening that they're going to get Champions League spot either. So, yeah, poor.
Stephen, it feels like there's going to be a lot of repercussions in the future because of this result, or this result is going to be one that will be referred to when decisions are being made. And a lot of the conversation now is revolving around whether or not Kane and Mourinho are going to be at the club by the end of the season or the start of next season. What do you think?
I think it's more important for Kane to be there than it is Mourinho. And that's probably a big statement, but I just think for the club going forward, they'll bring in another manager. They're bringing someone of good ilk and someone that you know, you're not going to get someone that's won as many trophies as Jose. And for me, I wanted it to work. It's not at the moment, and I still think maybe it could, but it's a big turning point to get the fans back on board from where they're at now. If they do win it, if they win the trophy, win the cup, then there's a chance that might things. But for Kane, no Champions League football for him. I think that's a deal breaker almost. You know, whether a team can come and afford him and buy him, that's something different. But for his perspective going forward and for what he wants to achieve as a player, I think if they're not in the Champions League, I think what it does is it stops Tottenham being able to bring in the players that they want to surround him with quality to be pushing them for the Premier League titles and Champions League. So I just can't see him staying unless England have an amazing Euros and that's it. That satisfies his tourist for a medal. But apart from that, I can't see it happening.
Stephen, it sounds like, listening to you as a former Tottenham player and a still Tottenham fan, you want to see the back of Jose Mourinho.
I'm kind of drawn. And I'm not really the type of person, like, I would happily say if I didn't think he was good enough. I like Jose Mourinho, and I'm probably one of the few people that does. Genuinely, most people I hear talk about can't stand him, and they don't like the way he talks about the players, but there's something about him, and from past players that I've known have played under him, literally sing his praises. And you know when you have a discussion with someone you've worked for before, you ask someone, what's that person like to work for? And the people that played under him have just been glowing reports about him. So I have this fondness for him. It's just not working at the moment, Tottenham. And it's him, but it's also the players, and it's both. And I know that comes down to the manager at the end of the day, but you know, I just think if they just throw some money at it and actually back him and back Kane, then they'd have a chance. But that's not happened.
It feels almost like it's too late, Conan. And just from a player's point of view, if you've got a manager who's coming out lambasting his players week in, week out, are you going to have any confidence in your own ability?
It's going to be very difficult, Marie, being totally honest with you. Luckily, through my career now, I never had a manager that kind of had that go at his players the way Jose Mourinho does. But as Stephen said there, judging by the quality of the players that he's had in dressing rooms, and that camaraderie that he has with his players, it's surprising to see that he's been doing it only in the last number of years. He has started this kind of having that go at players in his own dressing room, and it never works out well in any scenario. Does it work out well? So and obviously it didn't work out at Manchester United when he did it before, and he's starting to do it at Spurs, and obviously frozen out some players like Dele Alli and others, and it's just got a big fall from grace for him, unfortunately.
So Stephen, we know what Jose's at. What will Pep Guardiola's reaction be to his Manchester City players, seeing as they couldn't beat a 10-man Leeds on Saturday?
I think Pep is such a perfectionist. He'll be infuriated with them, and he'll highlight what they did wrong, the parts of the game. They still were dominant for most parts, and against Leeds, I actually think Leeds getting a man sent off actually helped them. And I know people say that's probably crazy, but it made them more resilient and more relaxed about going forward. They weren't pumping bodies into space and leaving themselves really exposed, which they do so often, and Man City would have just picked that apart. They were more inclined to get back men behind the ball and defend in numbers, and which stifled City a bit. But City made 7 changes, and I think at this stage in the league, that one loss in the game, I think for the greater picture of what they're going for, like the 4 titles, I think at this, you got to take a loss like that if you want to be fighting on all fronts. And, you know, the players he rested, look at their bench, it was just ridiculous.
Conan, I'm probably clutching at straws a little bit here, but when you see a team like Leeds and what they're able to do with 10 players against a Man City team, okay, grand, they didn't have a full strength, there was a lot of rotation, but at the same time, there'll be managers looking at that thinking, right, this is what we could do.
Absolutely, and there's been talk over the last number of years about Bielsa's teams as well, kind of fading towards the end of the season, and that's why Leeds hadn't been promoted in a couple of years in the Championship, is that they always faded off towards the end of the season. But it's having the opposite effect this year, and the likes of Stuart Dallas, as people know, his energy levels are absolutely frightening, and he has the stats to prove that he is always up there for the longest distances and his high-speed runs. And the fact that he was able to, with 10 men, with one all in, going into injury time, to make that run in behind. Now, obviously, John Stones was really, really poor. I thought he should have been stronger. But again, Stuart Dallas going through the team, and he kind of epitomises what Leeds are all about. Hard work, determination. And I thought Leeds were absolutely superb. And I agree with Stephen that once they went down to 10 men, it's like they did grow that little bit of resilience and got in as a group together and said, right, Man City, let's bring it on.
Stephen, obviously City are still 11 points in front by the time they go to Villa on Wednesday week. That might be 8. It's still too big a gap, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's still too big a gap, yeah. They've run away with the league, and, you know, they've taken their foot off the pedal slightly in the last few weeks when it comes to the league, because they know they've won it. They're still playing immense football, and no one's anywhere near them for their levels of consistency. Man United's put on a really good display the weekend, and they've shown that they, with a few probably additions to their squad, they could probably challenge. But I think a lot of teams are still way off what City are capable of, and like I said, the strength and depth of their squad and what they could possibly achieve this season, which I don't think you'd even put past them, with the way they're playing, it would be just phenomenal.
It really would. It would also be phenomenal, I think, as well, if you were to go back to the start of the season and say, right, West Ham are going to get top 4 football here, but they certainly seem to believe it anyway, Conan, the way that they're going out playing, and to come out and to beat Leicester at the weekend just kind of adds to how impressive they've been.
Absolutely, and I think Jesse Lingard has probably been one of the signings of the season, even though he's only just come in the last in the January transfer window there. For his first goal, incredible technique. A very, very difficult skill to be able to do that, to control a volley coming from that angle towards you. And 8 goals in 9 Premier League starts is a phenomenal return, and David Moyes deserves a huge amount of credit for bringing him in, but also lifting the morale and giving the West Ham players that little bit of
confidence in themselves to go out and say, look, we are a good side. Thomas Souček and Declan Rice in the middle of the park have been absolutely terrific. On the flip side of that, obviously Leicester have had a bit of an issue with some of their players over the weekend going to a party. And Marie, I think it needs to be brought up that like footballers are in a privileged position as it is. Like they're able to be in an environment that people can only dream of at the moment, having that little close bubble and being able to have face-to-face contact with people. And I think it's really, really poor from those Leicester players. And I hope I really do hope they are punished internally for it, because it's completely unacceptable.
I think they will be, Colin. But Stephen, when you look at that, it's going to be City then United. And you look at the next four teams, Leicester, West Ham, Chelsea, Liverpool. Liverpool beat Villa at the weekend 2-1. Probably could have been 3 or 4-1 being realistic, couldn't it?
Oh, could, yeah. Liverpool were... They just look... It was a game where you're watching them play and you kind of think they're going to find a way how to win this match. Whereas games gone by before that, you kind of just thought they were lacking ideas and were struggling, whereas you never really felt like that in the game. You always just thought they were going to come up with a solution how to win this game. And the, by no means had the strength they were before, and you know, the catastrophic injuries they've had over the season have definitely cost them. But I think they're going to get in the Champions League spot, and I actually think Chelsea will too. I feel that Leicester and West Ham will drop over, and that's no shame on West Ham, because they've been exceptional and the run of form they've been on is brilliant, and they actually have a good run in. But I just feel that Chelsea and Liverpool, I don't think they're going to drop as many points as those teams in this last leg of it.
I'm going to say what I always have been saying for the last while after I read a Malachy Clerkin article, is that you never know how bad things are going to get, so don't get too ahead of ourselves at all. But Stephen, I'm surprised actually I haven't asked you to give your opinion on Trent Alexander-Arnold, just because obviously you'd be an expert on the full-back position. Do you think that it's a bit harsh that he's not been put into the England squad, or is it fair enough?
I think it is really harsh. It is really harsh because... You know, it's one of those things where you're watching and you Southgate seems to talk about players based on current form. But it's not always the case for every player. And he picks and chooses sometimes. And maybe it's not, but you look at Eric Dier. He was in the squad, and what if he deserved to be in it? He wasn't even getting in the Tottenham team. So you kind of think, is that the case? And what Alexander can offer is very different to all the other fullbacks. He's technically... the best fullback in the country, technically, by a mile. His delivery into the box is second to none, and then with his goal scoring ability. But he does lack defensively what other players offer, and that's where Southgate, and I don't think he's ever been Southgate's first choice, and I don't think he ever will be, because he doesn't offer a defensive stability that he wants from his fullback. So if he was a right winger, yeah, and that's not a position for him. But as a right back, I think Trent falls down the pecking order, and I think that's just Southgate's opinion of him. And his drop in form was an opportunity for him not to pick him, and I know that was it for me.
Colin, speaking of form, Fulham losing to Wolves at the weekend, are they just destined for the drop now at West Brom and Sheffield United?
Yeah, really. I said last week that I thought maybe Fulham could get out of it, but. It's a big defeat, and the manner of it too is just such a hard blow to Scott Parker's team. Like Traore, Adama Traore, with a devastating finish, thought the keeper could have done a little bit better with it. But at the same time, I thought Fulham were on a good run in the last couple of weeks, and they've dipped slightly. And then with Newcastle's fantastic win away at Burnley, it leaves them 6 points from safety. Yeah, I think it's a little bit beyond them now.
And Stephen, your pal Steve Bruce must be pretty happy with their result at the weekend, beating Burnley 2-1, Newcastle.
Yeah, he'd be absolutely buzzing with that. I'm good for Fulham, but Brucey, just I suppose I'm delighted for him in a sense, because when you've worked with a man like that and you know the pressure he's been under and the stress he gets and the amount of abuse he's taken over the course of the season since he took over that job, really, for him to be in a position now where they look like they're going to be safe. And I think it's no coincidence that you've got these big players coming back from that have kind of carried the team. Sam Maxima, Wilson, Almiron, all of these guys are back fit. And when you have them in your squad, they really change the dynamics of it and how Newcastle perform. And Fulham just don't seem to have those players that can come in and really spring the team into life. But you kind of feel Newcastle now that should be it for them. Just keep those guys fit and they should have enough to stay safe.
Okay, Stephen, thanks so much for joining us as always. And we are going to keep Conan on the line. I'm going to chat League of Ireland, because talking about interesting results, they are still continuing, Conan, in the League of Ireland. I don't think it's really panning out the way anyone expected. And I think we should probably start with Shamrock Rovers and Sligo Rovers, because I think a game like that, you'd expect Shamrock Rovers to go out and win it, but it just shows just almost how unpredictable the league is now this year, that Sligo Rovers looked destined to win it until right at the end.
Yeah, well, I suppose Shamrock Rovers did have the majority of the chances throughout the game, and Stephen Bradley did say afterwards that they had chances to win two games. And it was an unfortunate mistake by Alan Manis in the Shamrock Rovers goal that gifted Sligo the lead with 10 minutes to go. And Sligo Rovers then should, obviously, Shamrock Rovers are going to come at them in the last 10 minutes, and they have to defend better than what they did for the Rory Gaffney goal. But Sligo have been untested this season up until this point, and I thought they acquitted themselves really, really well against the champions, and it bodes well for them going forward. They've got Europe this season, so but if they can push on and get into the top three, it'll be a fantastic achievement for Liam Buckley and Sligo Rovers.
Conan, Pats are top of the table. They won 2-0 on Friday night when they beat Derry City, who haven't won a game yet, and poor old Derry have Rovers tomorrow night. They just look like they're going to be rooted to the bottom for a while.
It doesn't look great for them, being totally honest, and they lack an attacking threat. They have no without David Parkhouse, that they brought him in over the winter break. He was with them a couple of years ago and he scored a lot of goals for them during the 2019 season. And without him, if he doesn't start scoring, Derry are going to struggle, really, really struggle. They have Jonathan Tunde as well. He's not the finished article by all means, but he's a good talent. Joe Hodge still is unfit to get a start as well, but they didn't help themselves on Friday. Danny Lapano getting sent off, he was already on a booking and he decided just to pull somebody back, automatic yellow card, and Declan Devine's face on the side of the pitch when it happened said it all. Rooted to the bottom, can't score goals, and as we both know, if you don't score goals, you don't win games.
Well, West Brom have just scored a goal. Speaking of them, they are 1-0 up against Southampton with Pereira finding the net after 32 minutes. Bowes also scored a goal on Friday night. We were talking as well about their difficulties with their attack, but they seem to be getting off the mark now, and it's Dundalk really that are struggling.
Yeah, Bowes had a terrific game after three poor results up to that point, three poor performances too, but they've put that to bed. They were absolutely superb. I thought the middle three of Ross Tierney, Keith Buckley and Ali Cook were absolutely brilliant in midfield. They dominated possession and harassed Dundalk's players, and in fairness, I think that's where the battle was won, the middle of the pitch. Dundalk, on the other hand, again, they got into good positions, but their end product was really, really poor. Mikey Duffy in particular, which is uncharacteristic of him. He's usually really, really accurate from dead balls and from crossing positions. And it was just unfortunate for Dundalk on the night that nothing went their way. They did have an absolute stonewall penalty denied in the last kick of the game. I don't know how the ref, it was a 100% a handball, wasn't given. And Bowes going back down the M1 with a fantastic 3 points thanks to Georgie Kelly, a former Dundalk player, penalty.
Colin, thanks a million. We're going to take a quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Since we have taken a break, West Brom have scored another goal, this time Matt Phillips, so they lead Southampton 2-0 with 35 minutes gone. Ruby, I felt at the top of the show we were kind of holding you back like the horse at the start of a race. You were mad to talk about Aintree and the Grand National and Rachel Blackmore. Now you can.
And Henry de Bromhead. And I think, unfortunately for Henry, he's been overlooked in so much of this. But for a trainer to win the champion hurdle, the champion chase, have the first two in the Gold Cup and the first two in the English National, that's never been done before either. So Henry just gets glanced over quite a bit.
Rachel actually in her interview said that straight after she had won it, she was like, I don't know what Henry's doing with these horses, but it's absolutely phenomenal. And it was actually the first time I thought about him in a long time. But what is he doing with the horses?
A damn good job, Marie. As simple as that. Look, he's been on an upward curve for quite a long time. Obviously, he got the backing of Alan Potts initially, and then Alan Potts moved on. Willie Mullins and Jigginstown split. Henry got a couple of those to keep him going, but he has attracted investment, got new owners, spent money wisely, and he's delivering on the biggest days. Now, he always has. I mean, special tiara size in Europe. He's always had plenty of good horses, but he's only 47, and he is becoming a very dominant force in Irish racing.
Yeah, he seems to be, and you're right, it is kind of getting lost in the story a little bit. He probably likes that because he's going under the radar a little bit and all the focus is on Rachel.
Yeah, but he also has the, I suppose, the intelligence and the manners to understand what's happening and to appreciate what Rachel Blackmore is doing, and it's not affecting his ego, because it could affect other people's, and it's not affecting his. He realises that he's doing a very good job with the horses he has, and that the investment and the reward will still come to him.
Ruby, you've been around racing and horses and sport for a very long time, and this really does feel like a moment.
It is a huge moment. I mean, you look back at dates and things that happened before my time, before I was even born, but it's only 1978 that Lorna Vincent was the first woman to ride a winner as a professional. That's 42 years ago, and she was on her own. I mean, Caroline Beasley in 86 won the Fox Hunters and Ellie Ogarty, but ladies as amateurs were always seen, but as professionals, like, it's just the way it's moved on, it's been incredible. And what Rachel has done in the last 12 months I think it's incredible. And I'm not sure, being a national hunt jockey, I never was sure it was for any woman, because I don't think it's for every man either. It is a hard sport, it is attritional, and she has broken the mould. And whatever about the riding of the horses, her tactics, her commitment to it, to me it's to take the falls along with the disappointment and get up and go back the very same and just keep starting again as if she never got the first fall. That is incredible to watch.
Well, you'd know all about it for sure, but I think, like, we know that she doesn't like being referred to as a female jockey or anyone focusing on her gender, but what she has succeeded to do by pure performance, determination and class and work rate and effort is that she has completely changed the landscape for female jockeys, for women jockeys, because it doesn't matter about the gender anymore. It is not going to be part of the conversation in the future because of what she has done, because of her performances, her attitude, the message that she has sent out, and just her sheer ability. It is about the performance. That is the most important thing. She has been compared to you.
Yeah, but the hardest part about riding horses, Marie, is actually getting the ride on them. It's not doing the riding part, it's getting somebody to put you on the best horse. That has always been the hardest part. I mean, you could be Matt Letizier playing for Southampton, one of the most gifted footballers in the world, but he was never going to win a Premier League medal playing in Southampton. And riding racehorses is the very same thing. You have to get to win enough that people believe in you enough to put you on the best horses. And that is what she's doing. I was lucky enough. Now, when you get on them, you then have to win on them and stay winning on them. But to get on them is the hardest part. And she's getting on them because she deserves to be on them. It's not we're going to back the lady. She's getting the rides because she deserves the rides. It's as simple as that. And that's what happens in a professional sport.
Yeah, you have to earn it. There's no tokens in, especially elite and the top, Ruby. But you mentioned that, I was reading your article in the Examiner today, and you said since 2017, you've even seen improvements in Rachel. Did that all come to a head on Saturday? Was that the
culmination?
Yeah, where you kind of saw it all coming together, that you're there, she's on it now.
It's the consistency. And that's where she's at. The tactical, even watching her from Cheltenham in 2020 on Honeysuckle, she got out of jail. She got herself into a poor tactical position and things happened in front of her that let her out. Cheltenham 2021, she was in a different position. She was putting the other riders in the wrong position. What she'd learned herself, even in that 12-month period. But to me, it's the complete package. It's to get over what happened on Jason the Militant on Thursday in the entry hurdle, where he jinked right and unseated her. It happens. We all lose our balance and you fall off. But to be able to put that in the back of your mind and go out in the Grand National like that never happened, and very few people can do that, let such a disappointment have no effect on the next ride you have or the couple of rides later, that's pure mental toughness, and that takes doing.
How did she get better? So if you're a jockey like Ruby, how did you get better as you went along? How was she getting
practice, and she said that herself, it's riding and it's practice and it's being able to critique yourself I was lucky, I always had my father to help me and to critique, but it's to look at yourself. It doesn't matter if you win, just because a lot of people will see you winning in sport and think you're doing the right thing. And Dunica, it's often the same in rugby. You can do things wrong and win, but you have to know that. You can't think, whew, I got away with that. That's what you're thinking, but you have to realise you made mistakes even when you're winning and think, I won't do that again. I need to, and you see it with her, she has definitely got stronger with her left hand to her right. She's right-handed, but she's worked more in her left hand, so you can't see the difference between left and right. Her tactical positioning, you have to be always willing to improve, and she is always improving.
We're seeing it in elite sport all the time because there's so many documentaries now and you're getting way more access to the professional teams like the Man Cities, and there's great AFL ones on at the moment, and we're the NFL ones of course as well, but you see all the analysis that they do, like the video analysis room, and sure Dunica, you'll know all about it. Like, do you do that in horse racing? Do you watch back
the
races?
But I remember having this conversation with Paul O'Connell, and he was on about the video analysis he was doing as a coach. Jockeys do their own video analysis because they're going to be on the horse's back. There's no point, and I was having the argument with him, like, why are the coaches doing the video analysis? It's the players that are going to be on the pitch. They should be doing it. Jockeys do their own video analysis. She will watch back her own rides. She will watch the form of the other horses, because ultimately she's the one on the racetrack that's going to have to make the decisions. She can't get a water break there at Beecher's Brook. A fella run on and tell her, by the way, the one four horses behind you is the one you need to watch. So, you know what I mean? You have to be aware of all those things when you're going out. And you do, but jockeys always did it. And I suppose you couldn't always do it. That's probably a luxury of the evolution of time and the improvement in technology. Before, you would have to come home and have it recorded and watch it at home. Now you can watch the replays on your iPhone on the way home. You know what I mean? You can sit in the plane and watch all the races by the time you get home and have analysed the form, and you get into the air and you can flick them on, and you can do it the whole time now. But it is a huge help, but you have to want to do that. You have to be able to understand the form, pick out the dangers, look at races and think where you want to be tactically, where you should be positioned, and have five or six different plans, because you're always thinking on the move. And it probably baffles me watching other sports when I think, right, you go out with a game plan, it's not working, change. Riders do that instinctively.
So when you hear somebody saying, stick to the process.
Stick to the process.
The process is fine as long as it's working. But you can't stick to the process when it ain't working.
Does every jockey do that, or is it just the ones at the top?
Every jockey does it, but it's like anything, Marie. Some people are able to do it better than others. And some people are able to process information quicker. Some people have a better retention of information. Some people are able to adapt quicker. But to me, the biggest thing is to be able to get over defeats. It's like I was always fascinated with Ronan O'Gara's mentality, and probably wrecked his head talking to him, how he would get over missing a penalty and take the next one or a decision. You know what I mean? And how he never let it affect him. And with racing, you had to do that. Like, and I remember back to different things that happened to me in my career. Like when Annie Power fell at the last, I had to ride the next day. I couldn't go and hide or take a week off. I had to go out and ride the following day. And, you know, you you have to learn to be able to deal with disappointment, deal with injury, and especially with as jockeys who are, I suppose, self-employed, and you have to learn to ride with injuries and learn to get on with it and park pain and just deal with it. And she has done it. She can do it all, and she is doing it all.
You would never survive in the rugby circles where it's all waiting to be spoon fed by the coaches.
Oh, I think you're spoiled, and
we know we're spoiled.
I look at her and I must say I hugely admire what she's doing.
Yeah, just on it, Ruby, like, we saw your reaction on TV, you watching it back, like, you had a whip in your hand, you know what I mean? You were giving it some every time.
I was, that was the last furlong, Dunica, but I must admit now when they were crossing the Mellon Road, I was shouting for my dad's horse, and he was unbelievably unlucky. And that's when Rachel, where you need, like I always say, you have to control your uncontrollables. It's a statement I never understood in my life. So they're going to the 12th fence in the Grand National. Rachel Blackmore moves right, Mark Walsh moves left. Who knows what's going to happen at the 12th? But double shuffle falls and falls left in front of Mark Walsh. If he fell right, he'd have fallen in front of Rachel Blackmore. And it probably cost any second out of the race. So to me, you could never control your uncontrollables. I think it's the most overrated and waffle of a statement of all time. But that's the bit of luck you need to have too. So I was shouting for any second out until I realised he wouldn't win. And then I was shouting for Rachel Blackmore. She'd had the disappointment of picking the wrong horse in the Gold Cup when she rode a Plutar instead of Manila Indo. And when they're going to the elbow in the Grand National, it's the other one she could have ridden that's coming at her. Balco to Flow, and I'm thinking, like, I know how hard it is to get over picking the wrong horse in the Gold Cup, and I'm thinking, I just don't want that to happen to you again. But then I just started rolling for her.
And Ruby, what about the Jockeys Championship? Obviously Paul Townend is injured, we're not sure when he's going to be back. Does she have enough time to overtake him?
She has 12 meetings. She's 6 rides tomorrow in Fairy House. She has 12 race days, and she's going to need a bounce of the ball, Marie. Her strike rate would just about get her there if Everton goes to plan, but I think the yards she's riding for need to be in hotter form than they probably are, and that's ultimately what it'll come down to.
Okay, we'll be keeping an eye on that. We're also keeping an eye on West Brom Southampton. It is heading for half time, and it's 2-0 with West Brom. We're going to take a very quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm on the go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, just so we can balance things out, Dunica, and we're not accused of any bias towards Munster, we're going to spend the last 10 minutes of the show talking all about Leinster and giving them loads of compliments.
Because Munster didn't play, Marie.
Exactly.
No, it was fantastic. We mentioned the Women's International at the start, and that was a fantastic win, and it kind of set it up nicely. Leinster were just dominant, though, and I know both of you would have watched the game. But just to hold nerve in... I know there's no crowds, but Exeter is a tough place to go. The pitch, it's one of these kind of a half all weather pitch, so it's really firm. It's really hard to get used to in terms of scrummaging, in terms of rucking and clear out. Leinster went 14 points down, and they just completely held their nerve and just took everything away from that we're used to Exeter being so good at.
So, Dunica, did they do nearly what the opposite of what Ruby is saying you should do? Like, they're 14 nil down against the European champions, and we've seen them doing it so often. They do just stick to the process, grind it out, execution, discipline, doing everything right that they do every week.
And, Marie, I think the biggest example of that was Johnny Sexton coming off. Johnny Sexton is more important to Ireland than he is to Leinster. And I know this might sound terrible, you know what I mean, that we kind of say, you know, he is massively important when he plays with Leinster. But Ross Byrne comes in, and the best way you can describe it, it's a machine, and there's all small cogs, and every cog does their job brilliantly. It's like an orchestra. Leo Cullen is running it there, and they all hit the right note. Ross Byrne to come on was immense. He really was, and there were some brilliant performances. Josh van der Fleer is worth a watch back. If there's any young back rowers out there looking out to be the best at your game, watch Josh van der Fleer for the weekend. His work ethic, his work rate was off the charts. He really was incredible.
Look, I was lucky enough to meet Jordan Larmour last year or 2 years ago at Carton House, and he really impressed me as an individual. What about his upper body strength? To get himself for the try, twisted in the air and down and ground the ball. And it even impressed Brian O'Driscoll.
Yeah, and Ruby, I'll be honest, wingers are practice on that now. There is actually, a part of their training session, it's finishing. And you can see it, it's probably come in from rugby league to get your body in the air or body fight to finish and complete scores. He's someone that's brilliant at it. But I think we've seen examples throughout rugby now where players are even getting airborne early. They know they're going to take a collision, they're going to take a bang. So can they actually get in the air and find a different way? And look, I think for me, that was just small examples for it. But Jordan Murphy, like, we would play a tip rugby with Jordan Murphy, and he would always finish. Normally they'd run under the post and you'd barely dot the ball down and pass it back on. Jordan would always finish. And I think it's a really important thing for guys like in underage to learn, that you always finish right. And that's what Jordan Larmour does every time. He finishes perfectly. And when you do it every day, it just becomes a brilliant habit.
And just to even add to the own Leinster bias here that we're going with, Mick Galway has even said Leinster's win over Exeter was one of Leinster's greatest performances. Would you say it was, Dunica?
Yeah, I think it was. I just knowing how hard it is to go there, knowing that, you know, Exeter had an extra week. I know everyone was saying they were fresher, but Exeter were battle-hardened. And the big thing, Ruby, was Exeter brought their best, and it was nowhere good enough. They really did. I think we're all used to, and I played in the Premiership in England, they beat most teams when they get into that type of an arm wrestle, and Leinster just put them on their arse every time they ran at it. So look, it's going to be really interesting now. They come up against Ronan O'Gara's La Rochelle, and that will be hopefully a step up. I was a bit disappointed with the rest of the rugby, if I'm completely honest, especially the Sunday's games. It just felt like the pressure's getting to everyone and it was win at all costs. We've three teams and Leinster into the finals or semi-finals, and I think, like we said before, it is so important for Irish rugby that they keep flying the flag.
What I love about the La Rochelle and Leinster game is that for the next few weeks it's just going to be, oh, Ronan Agara's playing against Leinster. That it's just going to be this narrative all the time about whether or not Ronan Agara can beat his rivals.
Yeah. And look, it's great that we're talking about him, and people do want to, you know, like Marie, I was slagging that everyone's, you know, oh my God, Ronan O'Gara is an amazing coach. But like, Ronan O'Gara has been coaching his teammates since he was 21 years of age. He's just used to doing that. Of course, he's acquired skills to get better at it. But I think it's wrong not to mention John O'Gibbs as well, who would have spent an awful lot of time with Leinster. And to be fair, they've been the standard setters. So I think guys like John O'Gibbs would have helped with the process of getting Leinster to where they are. He probably knows the fundamental blocks that are important. He does have an X factor team, though. He really does, that can bring it on the biggest occasions. But I think what I love about Europe is that tradition matters and earning it matters. And I think we're seeing a few teams make it. Racing,
as Rob Baxter learned after thinking it didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were having too much of a love. And like, look, there was no contest in ways in that game. There really wasn't. It was incredible to see. But I don't think Ronan O'Gara will come up with the same type of game plan. And he does have X factor players that can really put it up to Leinster.
Well, Ronan's interest in Irish rugby, to say that he's been watching, definitely watching the Irish national team, but his interest and understanding of Leinster surely will be a plus to his La Rochelle team, that he understands what Leinster will be trying to do.
Yeah, you know him better than anyone, but he loves it, Ruby. He will be watching everything. He will be watching A games. He will be, like you were chatting there earlier on about Rachel doing their own video analysis. If there's any game going on, he's all over trying to improve, trying to get better. You know, I was listening to him the other week saying that he's fascinated by Man City's work rate to get the ball back and just little things like that. He's always been like that. You know, he's always the one that asks the awkward question to push his team. And I think, you know, they're in a really good place because they're in bonus territory. Everyone is there kind of that they've probably overperformed, but he won't think that at all. He knows how hard it is to win, and when you get an opportunity, you have to be so, so selfish. So I think it could be closer than people probably give credit, you know, going into this match. I do think Leinster will have it all to do to travel and to get a result. But if anyone can, they possibly can. But it's going to be tougher than maybe people think.
And Donica, we spoke about Ulster last week as well, and they had a good win too. So Leinster aren't the only ones who have action to look forward to.
No, and they'll come up against Leicester Tigers, who, to be fair, are back. You know, they've taken a bit of a dip over the last few years, but what I like about the Leicester Tigers, Marie, is they were really honest. They were going, you know, we're nearly going to be poor for the next 2 years, but we're going to get back to the work we need to do and the team we need to be. And, you know, for me, it was always sad to see Jordan not. For me personally, I felt he could have been treated an awful lot better by that club because he's given so much to it. You know, Steve Bartwick has come in there now and he's putting his impression on it. What Ulster do really well, Marie, it's so hard to answer. It's very frustrating when you lose to it because they just go after you up front. And look, I think that's what I know the majority of Irish fans really appreciate, that it's the kind of nuts and bolts, the set piece battles, the mauls, looking after you know, the backfield. But it would be brilliant if Ulster could go on and do a Challenge Cup.
So you're talking about the pack again?
Yeah, lads, honestly, what's the saying? There's piano pushers and piano players, and you can have your Bevans playing the piano after Lindsay Pete does all the good work, you know what I mean?
Oh my God. And Dunner's moving forward, Leinster. Can they win it's a Challenge Cup, Darren?
Leinster come in. Yeah,
Ulster, I mean, sorry.
Ulster, yes, I would think so. Look, it's again, you know, the other one, I'm not too, it's Bath, isn't it, on the other side of that draw. So look, they won't be looking beyond Leicester Tigers, they really won't. And I do believe they can. And more importantly, when you chat to the likes of Stephen Ferris, just word around the camp, Ruby, is that they know they've been, you know, knocking on the door too long without silverware, and I think this is a perfect competition for them to actually go after and target.
Well, they do look like they are in a very good place. And just before we finish up as well, I know we were talking about the Ireland women's game from the weekend, and they are set to play France, hopefully anyway, all going to plan, because it looks like professional and elite athletes could receive an exemption from mandatory hotel quarantine under plans being worked on by the Department of Health and Sport. So that should become clear, so that will allow France to travel to Dublin this weekend if it does work out, and also it will have implications for the European Golf Tour's Dubai duty free Irish Open. So we'll be keeping an eye on that.